Hello, I'm Ingram Wright.
Hi, I'm Cliona Carroll, and this week we had the pleasure of speaking with Vicky Anderson, who's joined us from Melbourne in Australia.
Vicky was incredibly generous with her ideas, her thoughts on her trajectory in terms of how she has become an eminent paediatric neuropsychologist, but also how she's seen the discipline shape up and the challenges in the future. So welcome to the Neuro Clinic. We are delighted to have Professor Vicky Anderson with us. And I've got another treat in store because we've got a new co-host, Cliona Carroll. Cliona, do you want to say hello?
Hi, Ingram. Hi, Vicky. I'm Cliona Carroll. I'm a clinical psychologist and neuropsychologist, and I'm involved with the British Psychological Society as the early career representative. So I'm delighted to join us, the new co-host on the podcast with you, Ingram.
So Cliona's here because I clearly need help, right? I can't do this on my own anymore. And we've had a long break and a bit of a rest, and we've dusted off our mics and various things, haven't we, Cliona? You've got a new microphone.
I've got a new mic.
Very exciting. So we've invested heavily in this podcast, Vicky, and we've got a stellar guest to start us off. So, Vicky, I've been wanting to persuade you to come on this podcast for a while. Your book was the first book that I read that really drew me into paediatric neuropsychology. I imagine I speak for lots of people in that regard, and I suppose we'll get into some of that. But we have a convention in the NeuroClinic that people introduce themselves, and I was just explaining before we got on the recording that maybe it spares us the awkwardness of me introducing you, which I admitted to having done in a rather clumsy way in the past. So I've kind of learned my lesson. But are you happy to say a few words about who you are?
I am, Ingram, and thank you very much for inviting me to join you in this podcast. So I'm Vicky Anderson. I live down under in Melbourne, Australia. And I have a number of different hats in my role. So I'm head of psychology at the Children's Hospital. And I'm also the director of clinical sciences research at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, where I get to boss around a lot of surgeons and consultants and tell them how much money they have to pay their research costs. But I suppose my main interest is in child brain injury, hence being a paediatric neuropsychologist, and a very broad interest. So really over the many years of my career, I've looked at a range of different disorders, starting from brain tumours and leukaemia, and now more recently looking at stroke, and even more recently I've got a bit hooked on concussion.
Vicky, I just realised I made the mistake of saying I read your book, like you've only ever written one book, which is an example of the clumsy way that I sort of slightly misrepresent the canon of your research and clinical research output. So I do apologise for that. So it's always good to start a podcast with an apology.
Thank you
very much.
I think that was probably my...
We will append a substantial bibliography to the podcast output so that people can appreciate the breadth of work that you've undertaken. But I suppose one of the things that people are often really interested to know about is what got you into neuropsychology in the first place. I mean, are you happy to let us know how you got started out, what fired up your interest in this area?
Well, I suppose the first thing that happened was I lived in a country town and I really wanted to leave home. I loved my mum and dad, but I was very keen to leave home. And so I chose a course that I needed to do in the big city. And I thought I wanted to be a dietitian, but then I got to university and I had some lectures from Kevin Walsh, who some of you may know, many may not know, was really the father of neuropsychology in Australia and probably the father of the frontal lobes internationally. So he was an inspirational teacher and he very much had a model of neuropsychology that was a detective kind of model, spot the lesion, which I really found exciting. And he just opened up a whole range of really fascinating opportunities through his teaching, and he had me hooked. And I've been passionate about neuropsychology ever since. And that's a big thing because that was in 1978 when he lectured to us.
I suppose one of the things that sort of immediately interests me, I mean, I was born in 1970. I went to university in 1989. I was inspired largely from a developmental perspective, and again, have a bit of a story around, there were one or two people who presented developmental psychology in a particular way that really drew me in and fired me up. But I'm guessing the disciplines changed quite a lot since that time, Vicky. Is it still the same kind of space that was exciting to you at the time?
I think it really has changed a lot. When I was doing my training, you could easily read every paper on neuropsychology in a day. And now, you know, I can't even keep up with my own particular areas. I think there were some really good things that came out of being involved way back then, in that when I moved into a clinical role, I needed to see all kids who had brain injury. So I saw the cancer kids, I saw the kids with infections, I saw the kids with stroke. And so I got a really good sense of what each of those had in common and how they were different. And I think that understanding what was in common with all of them has really built my passion in pediatrics, because I do think that we can think about spotting the lesion and which part of the brain has been impacted. But in kids, often that's not so relevant, because what's been impacted is the developmental process. So the developmental blueprint has been derailed. And so lots of the kinds of conditions we see will have, as you know, Ingram, the information processing difficulties, so the slow processing speed, poor attention, poor memory. But not so much the kind of things that we would see in a similar insult in adults. So an adult stroke, you'll have aphasia or hemiplegia. And that's actually quite rare, at least in the longer term, in paediatrics. So that really piqued my interest in this whole issue of what is the importance of age insult. And a lot of my work since then has been really focused
on
this.
Sorry, Ingram. I'm really curious as well, Vicky, about your experiences around working with schools, working with the support networks around children, because I guess, you know, I'm an adult neuropsychologist. I have, you know, worked with kids at certain points, but I think my experience in some ways has been that lack of understanding around the systems, particularly around education systems around children, that can make a huge difference in terms of how difficulties are seen, maybe, you know, things being kind of identified as being like ADHD or autism or a learning disability, and how to pull that apart. And is that important to pull it apart? I don't know what your thoughts are. And that's quite a big question.
That's such a good question, though. And I might start with the end one and then the other one. So I see a lot of kids who have birth trauma and are very disabled, so that we know their brain is really abnormal. And so these poor kids who already have a cerebral palsy label or something similar will then get a label of ADHD or ASD because their attention is poor and their social skills are poor. And it just, from a neuropsychological perspective, it doesn't make sense, because we would expect those things to be poor because it's all part of how the brain functions. I think sometimes there is merit in giving those diagnoses for funding purposes, perhaps. But when I talk to families, I really like to emphasise that, you know, a child, even a child with less severe problems, doesn't have ASD and autism and a learning difficulty. They have, they're neurotypical, and all of these things are actually alike in some ways. And the new approach to psychiatry, the transdiagnostic approach, I think is really useful in kids, because it doesn't, you know, they don't leave your rooms with five different problems. They leave with one problem that has a range of different symptoms. And I always like to be able to, when I'm feeding back to families, be able to help them understand what their child, why their child is behaving in a particular way, but also have a little bit more hope and understanding of what the underlying issues are. Second question was around linking with services. And I know Britain, we have a universal health system. Our links with education are not great, but they're certainly reasonable. And for most kids, I would be talking to teachers or doing school meetings, even if I'm just doing an assessment. But if I think about our rehabilitation team, they're very integrated with schools and very much part of the process of getting kids back to school gradually and then further and further. I think the other element of integration is with the rest of the hospital. And when I started, people didn't believe in the view that early insult is worse than later insult. It was very much, oh, they're a child, they'll get better, their brain's plastic. And in fact, there are very few rehab services around for kids in those days. And I think gradually, as the research has built up, it's now become clear that it's a bit too simplistic to say younger age means worse outcomes, but that there are critical periods during childhood that are when it's really bad to happen.
Vicky, you were talking about how lucky you were, I suppose, to start. I don't know whether you would characterize yourself as lucky, but lucky to start work in an area that was growing and developing, and you could kind of read and embrace, consume everything. I had a similarly, I think, lucky experience in that I sort of cut my teeth as a clinical neuropsychologist, offering a comprehensive service to any referrals coming from our neurologists and community paediatricians. And it felt to me that there's a considerable advantage in seeing everything, because you see those commonalities, you see common themes in families who've experienced the trauma of having a child have an acquired brain injury, and there's much more in common than perhaps the research literature would lead us to believe. And we were talking a little bit before the podcast about how if you consume the literature now, you'll read lots of papers that about small series studies, small end designs with, you know, sort of rare populations. But what's striking is that there are common features. There's family trauma, there's difficulties with being accepted by your peers, there are problems often commonly presented with subtle executive regulatory difficulties. I'm guessing one of the corresponding difficulties that you might have is that you could be unlucky and work with a single population and carve out your research niche in that way. I mean, maybe lucky, unlucky is the wrong way to put it, but I mean, how do you, I'm guessing from the way you described yourself that you would consider yourself as someone who takes a much more holistic approach and embeds pediatric neuropsychology in a broader clinical context rather than pursuing a niche, if you like. That's a very long, rambling question.
Let's see how my working memory is to answer it. Ingram, I think I would see myself as holistic. So my training was very much neuropsychology, spot the lesion kind of training. And then I went out into pediatrics. And one of the hallmarks of pediatrics that's different to adults, I think, is that kids come with parents. So the child might have a brain injury, but the parent usually doesn't. And they have really tricky questions to answer. And they want information from you that is actually useful for them in their day-to-day life with this child. So all of a sudden, saying your child has a left temporal tumour or left temporal lesion is not particularly useful to your clients. And so I think pretty quickly I learned that I needed to do more than that. And I suppose, interestingly, I did my PhD on specific learning difficulties. So I got quite a good sense of what the key aspects were of learning in the classroom and what would help. So that really has stood me in good stead to be able to sit down and talk to a family about, you know, what's going to be the consequences of an auditory processing difficulty, or what's going to be the process of an emotional regulation problem. And I really find that that's the kind of information that people go away with and hang on to. And now, many, many years later, I often get young people ringing me up who I'd seen when they were kids, who have done really well despite all of their brain injury, and, you know, still have that yellowed copy of the report that I sent them. So, you know, I think it's just so much more meaningful if we can, and much more difficult too, to be able to move from behind our desk out into the world of our patient. But I do think it's really important. I'll get off my soapbox now.
Well, I was going to ask, go on.
I think another thing. At the Children's Hospital where I work, we have about 50 neuropsychologists, and probably double that in terms of clinical psychologists. And we have a hub and spoke kind of model where the psychologists working in cancer and psychologists working in rehab. But our central group takes the professional governance of all of the psychologists on campus. And what we try and do with that is bring all of the psychologists together, both clinical and neuropsychs, and do training together. So, you know, if we're doing CBT training, everyone comes together and they can all translate it into their own particular context, but they've all got the same set of skills. And I find that if you don't do that, then you get psychologists reinventing the wheel all over the place and wasting a lot of time. So I'm a big believer that we have a core set of skills that we all need to share, and then we can get our individual specialty knowledge and experience as well.
Go on, Cleena, you go.
This is a bit awkward, isn't it? Sorry, Ingram.
It's tricky. I'm used to living alone, Cleena.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
no problem.
All right. It's almost like there's a census in there of having kind of a group, like a core set of skills, but different lenses of how we might interpret or see those skills and use them.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, I mean, I'm a neuropsychologist that heads a department that's mostly clinical psychologists and counselling psychologists. And I think there was a lot of anxiety in the staff when I took that role. And probably I would say that our neuropsychologists are on the sort of the diagnostic end of the neuropsych continuum. But I think we've all learnt a lot. So I think the clinical psychologists who in our model don't spend a lot of time assessing have really got to understand the value of assessment, and equally the clinical neuropsychologists have started to understand and put in practice the fact that, you know, family dynamics are important, socioeconomic status and social disadvantage is important, whether a child had an argument with their mum and dad on the way into their assessment is a really important thing. So really thinking about what the child brings apart from their brain to the assessment.
It's formulation, context. Isn't it? It's always back to formulation.
Yes. That's why we can't replace computers.
100%.
Not yet, Vicky. Although somebody was talking to me about getting Chat GPT to write our neuropsychology reports. I don't know if it's something you've tried, Vicky. When I spot the backlog of reporting that I've got to do, I'm sorely tempted. I don't know whether you wanted to comment on... I mean, you mentioned that yellowed copy of a report. I mean, I think one of the things that we set our profession's reputation is often about how we can communicate neuropsychological principles to families. And you talked a little bit about this in relation to the sort of diagnostic questions that families will sometimes bring. They'll say, does my child have an autism spectrum condition? Do they have dyspraxia? Do they have this as well as temporal lobe epilepsy? And of course, we try and frame our responses in accordance with the family's needs. Do you have any sort of tips for people who are burdened with reporting? What is it that leads someone to hang on to that report as being particularly salient to them in their developmental journey?
So I think, and we were talking about this a little bit before too, I think it's really important in a report to not just talk about weaknesses. And so what I try and do is start with strengths in my reports, and then highlight the weaknesses, but with recommendations around how to support those weaknesses. And it's very rare that you find a family that aren't really aware of the weaknesses. In fact, you know, my comment to families is, if I'm suggesting something about their child that doesn't fit with what they see, then I've probably got it wrong. So, you know, I think they absolutely have they know at some level, they just don't have the terminology, and usually they don't have the knowledge and the experience to be able to figure out their way around things. And I mean, I use an example that just has stuck in my mind for years, when there was a very severely injured 3-year-old child who was in our rehab unit. And the physio contacted me and asked, and this isn't anything negative about physios, by the way, but she contacted me and said, this child keeps biting me. Every time I'm working with them, they bite me. And so I went down and sat and watched a session, and this child was nonverbal, so she couldn't say anything. And about 30 minutes into the session, remembering it's a 3-year-old, the child started biting the physiotherapist, but it was very clear that was her only means of communicating. She had had it. She couldn't do anything else. So, you know, I think so the physio was worried that it was a severe behaviour problem, but actually it was her trying. It was quite a positive way of her trying to let this physio know, and we could then change that behaviour to a different kind of behaviour and solve the problem. So, you know, I think it's that kind of understanding that's really important. And when I see students, and, you know, I often try and get my students to see a non-testable client, because it makes them very anxious, but it also, you know, I do give them some tips, but, you know, it makes them realize how much information they can actually get from observing. So trying to get them to take their head out of the test manual and watch what the child's doing, rather than just score it all up. And I think, you know, that's a really valuable skill we have as well. And I think all of that then goes into the report. So the whole picture of the child goes into the report.
And I guess our role as mentors, supervisors, managers, leaders within services is to support a generation of neuropsychologists in acquiring those skills and having balance within their clinical repertoire, because it is very easy to get stuck into your test manuals and test scores and those kinds of things. And the volume, sometimes the demands on us are such that we can miss some of the things that are perhaps harder to obtain the information that takes a little bit longer to get hold of.
Yeah, and look, I want to be really clear. I still think we need our manuals and our psychometrics, because they're, particularly in pediatrics, they're absolutely essential. They're essential in the context of understanding what developmental expectations are for a child too. So, you know, I think that's important, but absolutely. And I think one of the other things that happens, I'm having a gripe about my profession at the moment, but I think we get very hooked on test batteries, and we have to do all of these things with every child we see. And look, I'm biased. I grew up in an era of hypothesis testing, where we, you know, we did do an IQ test, and from there we went and had a look at what the issues were that we needed to delve in deeper, but we didn't do multiple full tests. And, you know, I do think there's value in that, formulating along the way what we need to do next, and that also saves us time and allows more time to see more kids.
I'm guessing, set against that, and I suppose we're going to talk a little bit about research. So one of the things that maybe drives us to be less flexible, more systematic, to do the same with everyone, is having a clear research agenda. It is important we do this test, because we always do this with children with this particular tumor or whatever it is. I'm guessing you've had to balance out some of those concerns about, we need to be systematic if we're able to succeed and gather evidence around outcomes in particular cases. So there is something that you're saying, which is very powerful and persuasive, about your clinical orientation, but you've clearly also been very successful in the research domain, Vicky. How have you managed those tensions?
So I think there's a bit of a chronology here that's important. So when I started doing research, when I started doing a new research project, I'd always try and get funding for that research project. And bearing in mind that that was a time where we really didn't see, there weren't that many neuropsychologists, so that a lot of kids didn't get seen. So, for example, when we did our leukemia study, where we were looking at the impact of chemotherapy and radiotherapy, we got a small grant, and so we could, there was no neuropsych service. And so we saw all of those kids and we provided them with reports, clinical reports, and we did a very formal neuropsych assessment, standardised neuropsych assessment, which was clearly important for research. But as a result of that, when the research stopped, there was no clinical service, and so the oncologists actually employed neuropsychologists. And the very same thing happened in the traumatic brain injury area. We did assessments on, 200 kids over 2 years. And then we were no longer there and available because our research had finished. And so there were neuropsychs to come in and do that work. So I think it's by doing it, and I'm talking about in an academic medical context, the research is a way to show the medical departments how useful neuropsychology can be. And in that way, you build your resource. And now we have, as I said, lots of neuropsychologists across all those departments. I think our clinical resource is very tiny compared to the need. And we have at any one time, we've got a 6-month waiting list. So I suppose I have always tried to separate out the funded clinical work from the funded research work as much as I possibly could. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, we have, as most places, have got a nice database with all of our clinical data in it that we can use, but we don't kind of tailor our clinical assessments for research purposes, I suppose, in our particular.
I think context. There's a real learning there for the UK, because correct me if I'm wrong, Ingram, but I think my impression often is that it's clinicians trying to build business cases on top of their own clinical work, rather than kind of, that is quite a different model to use the research funding to demonstrate the need to build your business case for having this service. I don't know, Ingram, if you've ever come across that in UK. I know I certainly haven't, but
I guess there are all kinds of drivers, aren't there, for the way that we do things. So we've talked about, what is in your mind as a scientist, as a neuropsychologist, as a clinical psychologist when you meet a family. But I think what you're alluding to, cleaners, is also a kind of service context. There's also the kind of pressures of the work, what you need to produce, what you need to develop, how you need to grow personally. And we have to reconcile all of these different drivers, don't we, around our practice. I think what's really powerful about hearing you talk, Vicky, having picked up that book and, become a neuropsychologist or transform myself from a developmental psychologist into a pediatric neuropsychologist on the back of reading your work, is to hear you talk now and to reflect on, I guess, experience that has been accumulated over time and a perspective that's developed over time. Is, I think sometimes it's hard for us to tell when we're in the middle of our career or at the early stage of our career, what kind of neuropsychologist we ought to grow into, if that makes sense. And I guess a big part of your role, Vicky, is mentoring, supporting, nurturing. You described the opportunities to be bossy. I can't imagine you being bossy, but I imagine there are moments. But I guess a lot of the work that you'll do with people who are aspiring neuropsychologists is not about being bossy as such.
No, I do have a quite impressive Italian temper but I don't usually apply it to my staff, more to my kids, they would say. I absolutely love clinical work, and if I had to define myself by one label, I'm a clinical neuropsychologist, and the one thing I would not give up, and as I'm not that far from retiring, the one thing I really will not give up is seeing patients and their families. But the other thing I absolutely love is working with young people. And my team is, in our research team, it's quite a big team. We have a number of neuropsychologists, but we have lots of budding researchers, clinical psychologists, and we have an intern program, a volunteer intern program, which is amazing to me that these young people come and give their time, often for our concussion study, on weekends and after hours to work with us. And they're just so inspiring. They do all my reading for me. And, you know, whenever I'm with them, I love the fact that they really challenge the ideas that you have, because as you get older, you get a bit stuck in your ways. So it's just great to have people challenging ideas, bringing you up to date with things. And in that context, I think more recently, so a lot of my research was really focused on describing problems. How many papers are there on cognitive problems after brain injury? And in the last 10 years, probably, we've really changed tack and thought, you know, anything that we're going to learn now is really incremental. And all this work is sitting in journals, in books that no one in the community reads. And actually, how can we implement it and make it available to others? So a lot of our research more recently has been trying to apply the knowledge that we've developed into interventions. And one of my favourite stories is our online intervention for parents of kids who have severe life-threatening disorders. And so they're very traumatised. And because our research shows very clearly that parent mental health is a big predictor of child outcome, we really wanted to support those families. So we built this acceptance commitment therapy intervention. This doesn't sound very neuropsychological, I know, but we did have the clinical psychologist in the room too, which we tried to deliver face-to-face. And, of course, the parents would not come into the hospital, so we had to learn how to do this intervention online. And we tried all these different platforms that were really clunky. You might remember GoToMeetings and things like that. But anyway, we developed this intervention, which parents absolutely loved, and dads actually came along to it because we did it after hours. So it was just, and it was a great intervention. It made a really big difference to families. We got great feedback. And of course, then came COVID, and we all had to go online, and this intervention was there ready to go. So, you know, I think those kinds of things, using new technology and new ideas, and also listening to your consumers and what they want, is really important. And the other area that we're doing quite a bit in now is the whole digital health app kind of area. And that's really exciting too, because I'm a big Aussie rules football fan, and I get now to go and talk to clubs and talk to players about concussion and our app and etc. So it really feels like it's really rewarding now that we're actually doing something that people are interested in and can find useful.
I mean, there's a hint of an apology for doing therapy there, Vicky, around that interface with clinical psychology. I find myself on a similar journey, becoming, you know, I consider myself a novice ACT therapist, but realizing, I suppose, that we do need to translate some of our diagnostic biases into something which is which has a more diverse application and impact. And as you say, recognize that actually some of the most powerful interventions are with the wider system, aren't they, rather than spotting an association between a form of temporal pathology and a memory problem. I mean, that clearly has value, and we mustn't disregard our foundations, I suppose, as neuropsychologists, but we do need to be able to translate that into an environment that's changed quite radically in terms of where interventions happen.
Yeah, and look, I would really argue strongly that intervention that I talked about would not have been as effective if there wasn't a neuropsychologist in the room, because when families would say, oh, my child is doing that, my child is doing this, we could then say to them, well, you know, they're recovering, it's pretty typical. Whereas the clinical psych didn't have that knowledge. So, you know, I do think that we have really key knowledge in, when we're working with kids with brain injury, that we need to be able to contribute to any therapy that kids have and kids and families have.
There's something in what is neuropsychology, isn't there? Of, you know, what is neuropsychology anyway? Is it about kind of testing and identifying weaknesses and strengths kind of in cognitive processes? And I think that's the beautiful thing about pediatrics, particularly when I've, you know, worked with pediatric patients, is that this is a kid. Like this kid, you know, this is one part of them. And where I think kind of when I work with adults, and this is a very generic statement, like kind of really, but a lot of the adults that I work with, like this thing, this neurological condition becomes a huge part of their identity, where with kids, it doesn't become so all consuming, maybe in the systems around them. But that's the beauty of neuropsychology for me, and what I love passing on to kind of doctorate students in clinical psychology is like neuropsychology, you get to use every single clinical skill that you've ever learned, everything, it's all in there.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that you know, we've only got ourselves to blame if we put ourselves in a box, because I think our skill set is just so valuable in so many different contexts. And, you know, the proof of that is the way we've grown as a profession in a time when the health budget, when the health dollar has really decreased. I'm not sure in the UK, although from the people I know, it seems that it's a growing profession in Australia, particularly in the East Coast. It's growing so fast that we just can't keep up with the demand for neuropsychologists. And, you know, and if I say to my students who are doing research, that the other element is that as psychologists, we don't realise how valuable we are in that research space. Doesn't matter what is being researched. Our degrees have so much statistics and research methodology in them that you go into a hospital, you know, academic hospital, and they're wanting to do research. And, you know, one of our honours students can make a major change to a very poorly developed protocol just because they know that work. And so you put one of our students in those kinds of contexts and people love them, the doctors love them. So it's, you know, I think we've got such a broad skill set. So you can work clinically, you can work in research, you can work in policy making, you can work in education, huge, huge areas.
Lena has a confession, Vicky, which brings us on to the question that I was keen to ask you, and I think it's sort of something we've implicitly addressed going forward, particularly around the distinction around pediatric and adult neuropsychology. We mix and we're quite friendly with our adult neuropsychology colleagues, aren't we, Vicky? I've conceded a seat on this podcast to Kleena, but Kleena, you've faced a bit of a dilemma, haven't you, around the pull of pediatric psychology. The enthusiasm that is brimming from Vicky's experience around the richness of the discipline. I mean, are you persuaded to?
It's I know, like Ingram and I, we've had this conversation multiple times. So I finished my qualification in adult clinical neuropsychology 2 years ago and immediately had a midlife crisis where I thought I'm just going to do the pediatric neuropsychology training straight away. And then realized that maybe I should have a break. But I've always kind of had that pull back to pediatrics and had that, like, I love working in neuropsychology. It's my absolute passion. But there's just something really special, I think, when I have, you know, I've had some opportunities to work with children kind of when I was training and even still now under the supervision of pediatric and neuropsychology colleagues. But there's something really special about working with kids. But I guess I wondered, Vicky, what your advice might be to somebody who's having that dilemma. Is it adults? Is it peds?
Yeah, I often get asked this question. And just kind of for disclosure, so my first job was in a geriatric rehabilitation centre. And through my career, because I'm adult trained as well, through my career, I've worked in lots of adult contexts. So I worked at what we call the Eye and Ear Hospital here. I worked in an adult neurology clinic. So I've done quite a lot of work in adults. And, you know, I think that all of those different contexts are great. I think what I like about pediatrics, I think kids are easy to test. Often with adults, it's really hard to get past the barrier of them being tested, whereas kids just walk in and it's just like school. Or they don't when they're little and they, you know, climb under the table and you've got to climb under the table with them. So I like that kind of, I like that kind of dynamic. And I like that often there's a competent set of parents there that can put into practice and support whatever we're suggesting. So it's quite a hopeful profession. But, you know, I think my advice to even my best students who I'd love to stay working in pediatrics is that it's really important not to kind of pigeonhole yourself right at the beginning of your career. You need to, because, you know, if you don't try something like geriatric rehab, you're never going to know whether you like it or not. So, and then if you've never tried it, you're never going to get a job in it later on because you're going to be pigeonholed as a pediatric neuropsychologist. I sometimes get asked if I have to give evidence in court, you know, how can I possibly have assessed a 25-year-old? And I think, well, not only because he had his injury when he was a kid, but because we've got skills that can really cover the age span. I think the one thing that I think is different in pediatrics and also probably different in geriatrics is you have to have an understanding that there's a rapid developmental trajectory. And I was never more conscious of this than when I worked with Ian Robertson and Tom Manley developing the test of everyday attention for children, because they obviously had the test of everyday attention, which was great. And, you know, if you look at the manual, they had a very small standardisation sample. Now, if you want to translate that for children, you can't have a small standardisation sample. You've got to have kids at every part of that, you know, that age trajectory. So it's, you know, it's really that acknowledgement that normal kids change rapidly. And if we're going to be accurate in what we test, we have to be using really good norms to compare to. So I don't know whether that answered your question, but I think it's neuropsychology, the discipline, that inspires me, and the brain, rather than a particular age group, but in terms of who I like to interact with best.
And I think kids. Like for me, you know, my midlife crisis, do I do peds, like kind of neuropsychology training straight off the back of adults? I think I remember going to a podcast, going to an online training event and thinking, oh my gosh, wow, this is massive. Like this isn't just, oh, well, I'll just tag on peds. Like, and it'll be a quick, you know, 6 months I'll learn peds neuropsychology. It really does feel like there's a lot of additional stuff in pediatric neuropsychology. And I think that's, it's not necessarily always recognized that this is a different, you know, there's similarities, isn't there, as you say, Vicky, but it is different.
Yeah, and I think the whole interaction with schools is a really big one. And if we're talking about kids with brain injury, the transition points are really important. And so while you might see an adult once and that's fine, with kids who've had a significant injury, you really can't leave it at that, because, you know, if they were preschool and then they had to go into kinder, that's a big jump, and you have to spend a lot of time supporting families and kinders at that point. And then they go into school, and then they go into high school, and then they have to find a job. So, you know, those transitions are really important. And of all of those transitions, I think the most challenging but the most interesting is adolescence. And, you know, working with adolescents who have a brain injury is just the hardest thing. I think the only time, well, maybe a few other times, but the only time I've really been sworn at really, really angrily was by a 14-year-old girl who'd had quite a severe brain injury, who had been a really good basketball player. She couldn't play basketball anymore. And I was telling her how she was doing quite well cognitively, and she just let loose at me saying, I don't really care, you know, I can't play basketball anymore. And I think it's that, you know, the loss of identity in that age group when they're quite aware, but they've still got their future ahead of them, which has now been derailed. That is, it's such a critical time. So it's not just paediatrics, it's the stage of that childhood path that's also really important.
And what's interesting, Vicky, about the different, I suppose where we started, how one might define oneself, right? That you're saying, actually, I haven't always been exclusively a paediatric neuropsychologist. I mean, like I said, I consider myself coming from a strong developmental tradition. I really enjoy the challenges of assessment in infancy. It's a very different space to occupy, requires a different skill set. The same is true, isn't it? Working with adults, cleaner, working with older adults, working in a very different developmental context. Vicky, I was struck when I was doing a PhD, working alongside people who were working within a developmental framework, but with older adults, looking at aging. Again, as you point out, a very dynamic space to be working in where a developmental perspective is entirely appropriate. And maybe we should stop dividing ourselves up in these conventional ways. Yes, it's helpful to communicate, I'm a child neuropsychologist, I'm an adult neuropsychologist, but it's probably not how we would choose to define ourselves in too categorical a way.
Yeah, I agree. And I was saying, I thought there were similarities between the paediatric and the geriatric, but the issue is about being considerate and thinking of your patient, not thinking of what you're going to do, but your patient. And I suppose I think of some of the experience I've had with adults where when I first started, I would, be talking in long sentences and, older people needing more time to process, or they'd forgotten their hearing aids and I thought that they were demented, but actually they just couldn't hear what I was saying. Or, now I watch some of my students and they're trying to get their elderly patients to use an iPad. And yeah, sure, some can use it really well, but others just do not get it and they're never going to get it for various reasons, not necessarily because they're demented. So, I think all of those issues about really, again, coming back to being aware of the person in front of you, and if you've got an environment for them that is optimal for them to show you what they can do, and making sure you do as much as you can to get that. So I agree with Ingram. I think that we can divide ourselves far too narrowly. When we've got this broad, we do have a set of skills that can cover the age range, so long as we're observant.
I was at a conference last week, the Ahead Together conference. It's a conference here that's been set up in the UK that really looks at families after brain injury. But one of the speakers spoke about this idea of like break bread with us. And that idea of, it's really what you're talking about, isn't it? Like kind of come and break bread with us, find out how it is for us. It's not about how it is just in this, hour and a half assessment. It's all of the other stuff that we need to kind of bring to the table. And, if you can understand us, it's almost like kind of that sense, isn't it? If you can understand us, like kind of then you can help us, like kind of, and we can understand you.
Yeah. And we can trust you because you've made the effort to understand us. Yeah, I some of the most confronting things I've done is some home visits with families with kids with very severe injuries. And, I come out just being so admiring of the family and, having to manage trackies and pegs and, lifting kids here and there and, catching them when they're breaking things and throwing things. And it's so different to the test room that it's really important to see that. Not too often, I have to say, but it does just remind you of how difficult it can be.
Vicky, we've asked you a number of what ought to have been challenging questions, but you've managed them admirably. But I'm going to make things slightly more difficult for us all now, with both technically and intellectually. We've got some questions from a genuine child neuropsychologist, Elliot, who is 5 years old, who's a son of a friend of mine, has submitted, knowing that you were going to be on the podcast, has submitted a series of questions that he would like a pediatric neuropsychologist to answer about the brain. And I think you've kindly agreed to answer Elliot's questions. Is that right? And you haven't heard these, which is extraordinarily brave.
I'm a pediatric neuropsychologist. I'm used to difficult questions.
I have had the advantage, just full disclosure, I have had the advantage of listening to these questions. So I'm quite happy to think on my feet, but having had some forewarning of what the questions are. If you want to pass on any of the questions, Vicky, I think we'll allow you. There are 7 questions. And Cleena, if you can do the co-hosting of counting Vicky's passes. So any that Vicky passes on, I'm happy to answer. But we'll only give you 3 passes, Vicky. Does that sound okay?
Okay. It's like
great.
Yeah.
Vicky, you ready for the first question? So here's the first question. You can choose to answer or pass, right?
Why do we have
what
dreams?
What do you think about that one?
I'm not sure that's one in neuropsychologists.
Is that a pass or is that you playing?
I can dredge up my limited sleep knowledge and talk about REM sleep and how that's a stage where you have dreams, but I'm not quite sure I can say why we have dreams. So I might have to give a
Lots
pass
of great
on
research,
that.
Isn't there, on sleep and learning and consolidation of learning and the role of sleep. And I guess, as you point out, it doesn't necessarily fully address the question of why we have dreams, does it? But there does appear to be certainly some clear neurocognitive functions of sleep and consequences of disruption to sleep. And is a common thing, isn't it, we would see in kids with acquired brain injury. I think in terms of Elliot's questions, though, and our the rules of this particular game, Vicky, it's posed a problem because I think that was probably half a pass if we're counting it strictly. So clearly, it's even more of a challenge for you to count half marks.
I'll put a half a pass.
Would you like the next question, Vicky?
I hope they're not all that hard, but yes.
I think that was one of the hardest ones. I don't know why it's in this particular order. It's somewhat random, but here's the next one from Elliot.
Do I really have to wear a helmet to protect my brain?
Well, Elliot, that's one I can definitely make a comment on. I think that the answer to that is it depends on what you're doing. So if you're riding a bike or if you're skiing or snowboarding or playing cricket, really important to wear a helmet because it'll protect you from missiles like cricket balls hitting your head and damaging your brain. If you're playing something like junior soccer or similar kinds of sports, sometimes a helmet can get in the way because it makes your head bigger and it puts more stress on your neck. And it also, with some kids, makes them feel like they're Mr. Invincible and to take risks when they wouldn't otherwise do it. And that can mean that kids are more likely to have injuries. So I think my answer is sometimes it's good to wear a helmet and sometimes it's not.
I think Elliot's parents will be really pleased to have your definitive advice on this topic, Vicky. So thank you very much. I think there was no even half passes on that question, Cleena. Cleena's shaking her head. We're fine with that one. Are you ready for question 3, Vicky?
Yes, I am.
What foods are good for your brain?
I think that's a difficult one. When I heard this, I thought, oh, I don't know.
I think it's a difficult one too. You know, I think the kind of the old wives' tale would be fish oil might be the answer for that. But I think really a healthy diet and a healthy lifestyle is really important. So everything in moderation to me is good. So, you know, even to the extent that sometimes kids will be told that sugar is bad for them. But in fact, we all need some sugar to keep us active and not get fatigued. So we do need some sugar, but we also need vegetables and proteins and so on. So I think it's really making sure that you've got a broad diet that's important, particularly when you're young and your brain's developing. And I suppose just as a bit of an aside, we do know that for kids who live in very disadvantaged environments and don't get enough to eat at all, we see that their brains actually don't develop very well. So food is really critical to developing a healthy brain.
Thank you, Vicky. Question 4 from Elliot. Here we go.
Is it really true that half your brain is made out of water?
That's a technical question, Vicky.
More than half of your brain is water, actually. So yes, that's definitely true.
Thank you. It's a lovely, succinct answer.
It's a lovely, succinct question, too.
Why can't you remember being a baby?
Oh, now that's a really interesting question. And I will give my thoughts on it. Might not be the perfect answer, but our memories rely a lot on our language skills. And so when we remember things, we often remember a conversation or the labels that we put on things rather than the smell or the visual picture. And when we're babies, we don't have any language, and so we don't have any of those labels to put on what's happening to us. But pretty much by age 2 or by age 3, we can start doing that really well, and that's when we start having really good memories. In saying that, just to give a little bit more information, some people who had very traumatic things happen to them when they were babies, they have really clear memories of smells that might have been around at the time. Like if they happen to be in a really nasty fire, they'll remember that smell, but they won't remember any of the words around it. So I hope that answers your question, Elliot.
A wonderful answer, Vicky. Thank you. Got 2 more questions. I think you haven't used any of your passes yet. I'm slightly worried about what do we do if you finish these questions in credit and you've only half passed on one question. We'll have to send you some book vouchers or something like that as a credit.
Next time I see you.
You can come on the podcast and refuse to answer any questions in future. Here's question number 6, penultimate question from Elliot.
Is your brain really walnut shaped?
It's another technical question. Is your brain really walnut shaped?
It's sort of walnut shaped, and you know, it's like a walnut in that it has two pieces that can pull apart. Hopefully not when you're alive, but yeah, it is a bit walnut shaped, and it's a bit kind of lumpy on the outside too, like a walnut. So all of the brain has lots and lots of folds in it that grow and get more and more over time from the time when you're before you're born till the time you're born. So, yeah, I think that's a really good way of describing it.
You think, Vicky, can I ask it? No, I maybe shouldn't ask a follow-up question. I don't want to contaminate Elliot's questions, but I suppose these questions about understanding our brain are quite important, aren't they, to communicating with families? So when I heard Elliot's questions, I thought, you know, these are really interesting and challenging questions, aren't they, about how we communicate with young people, how we communicate with families, how we address issues of how vulnerable our brains might be because of their shape, because of the anatomical aspects of how the brain fits into the skull, etc. All of these things are relevant, aren't they, to our work? They're not necessarily something we would say, actually, that's for the neurosurgeons or the radiologists to talk to you about.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that last question about the shape really gives the opportunity to talk about how the brain starts off as quite smooth.
Yeah.
And then as the volume grows and grows, it doesn't have a bigger space to grow into. And so it folds itself over and over again, and all those folds are critical to how well it functions. I agree. I think Elliot is a neuropsychologist.
I think he may well be on that pathway, I'm hoping. Well, Elliot will no doubt be interested to listen to this podcast, and maybe he can make a decision afterwards. Here's his last question.
How can our brains think about our own thoughts?
I think that's possibly the most difficult of the questions, and we've saved it for last. How can our brains think of our own thoughts?
Oh, so I think our own thoughts are from our brains. So we can be in a certain situation, for example, and we can feel something, and then on the basis of that, we can put that into some kind of context that the brain then interprets for us. And often what happens is that process ends up in some kind of language-based output. So that the stimulus might not be language-based, but what our brain does is translate it into those words. And that's a bit of a clunky kind of answer, but...
That was a great answer, Vicky.
I can drink.
Well, thank you very much for answering Elliot's questions.
Vicky, six and a half, Vicky.
What was that?
Six and a half.
Six and a half.
They were tricky.
Really tricky questions. And I think one of the things you talked about, what you enjoyed about working with children, Vicky, and I think sometimes when one's asked that question, you come up with different answers each time or variants. And I quite enjoyed that. I've quite enjoyed crawling under the table to get an assessment of some kind done. And it's a great thing about working with children that you're faced with those kinds of challenges. But I also think Elliot's questions exemplify something that's great about working with children, is they'll ask you the toughest questions, right? They won't, you know, sit back and shyly, you know, kind of avoid exposing you and your limitations. They'll ask you some really, really tough things. And I quite enjoy being put on the spot on occasion in my work. I'm sure we all do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with those questions, you can see Elliot's cogs of his brain working. You can see what him trying to get a better understanding. And I love that. I love being able to kind of feed information into that brain.
Keeps our cogs whirring as well, answering the questions.
I've certainly learned a lot from your answers, Vicky.
I'm glad.
I've got a final question for you, Vicky. And I suppose we talked a little bit about how you got into neuropsychology and how the field has shaped over time, and maybe changed and developed, become more specialized and much more extensive, I suppose, in terms of the volume of work that is published in the name of neuropsychology. But as someone who's been a leader in the field for such a time, where do you think we're heading? Where do you think we need to go? I mean, you've talked about some of the challenges, technology, apps, online therapy, I suppose the place that we're living in now, but where do you think we're going to be heading in the next 10 or 15 years in terms of neuropsychology?
I think it's really hard to tell, because if you had asked me this, where we would be now, yeah, when I started my training, I mean, we didn't even have computers back then. So the amount of change is enormous. And you mentioned ChatGPT before. Yeah. Those kinds of AI developments offer such huge input. I think that we're likely to just have ever expanding use of technology, digital technology, online technology. I think that, well, I hope that we take advantage of that to be able to disseminate our knowledge as best as we can, not just to our neuropsychology colleagues, but to our patients and clients and families, so that it's really easily accessible. I think that's really important. I think we, as the health system kind of gets more precision based, I think there's a bit of an argument for us to get less precision based. Because, you know, we get so focused in on these medical things and the minutiae of really particular diagnoses, that I think it's really important for us as psychologists in general to keep our big picture and to be able to maintain that approach, to be able to look at holistically at whoever we've got on in front of us or on the screen or whatever, and really be able to maintain that kind of human element to what we do. I don't quite know what kind of platform we'll be doing it on in 20 years' time, but I think, you know, if you think back to Freud, I'm not necessarily psychoanalytic in my background, but what he was doing and what we're doing now, you know, has a lot of similarities in that sitting in a room, formulating, making interpretations, you know, and that's a century on, despite all of the progress that's been made. So, you know, I hope we really do keep that kind of human touch to what we're doing.
Vicky, thank you ever so much for sharing your wisdom, perspective and experience with us. It's been an absolute pleasure. I mean, if I'd known when I was turning over the front cover of that one and only book that I knew about at the time that inspired me to pursue a career in pediatric neuropsych, if I knew that I'd be talking to you in this forum, you know, if I could have predicted that future, I would have been absolutely delighted. So thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure and great to talk with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.